Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
On our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking about models of home visits. And we're going to be talking with Dr. Alan Kronhaus, co-founder and CEO of Doctors Making House Calls in Durham, and with Dr. Chrissy Kistler, the medical director of the REACH program at the University of North Carolina, about innovation in the house call movement. I'm really excited about these conversations.
I am too, and I think many of our listeners will be encouraged to hear both about new models of taking care of patients and about different ways that they could think about getting the care that they need or caring for loved ones, not just from the traditional office visit.
I think our listeners will also be surprised. House calls are still an integral part of medical training, certainly of family doctors and primary care doctors, and this is some models of serving.
Very exciting. Okay, but first we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about concussions in female high school athletes that may be underreported.
We'll talk about oral contraceptives and possible links to depression.
We'll talk about new research that suggests the possibility that women's ovaries can grow new eggs.
And we're going to talk about the Mediterranean diet. Can you make it even better? Really exciting. Let's talk about the very first research that matters, Christy, about concussions in female high school athletes. And I just happened to see last week, a woman came in with a concussion that she'd had 2 days previous. And it wasn't until she developed a black eye and her colleague said, you know, you probably should go get this looked at, that she came in. And indeed, she had had a concussion.
This is something near and dear to me, as I have a daughter who's an athlete, and I know you do as well. But thinking about the importance of concussions, we've talked about it on the show together, Adam, and the fact that, at least in this study, suggests that maybe in female athletes, they underreport in some way, but they may be more often than we know.
Yeah, this was published in the Journal of Trauma Nursing, and this was 77 high school female athletes, and about 31 of them said that they had sustained a concussion, about 40% of them. But of the 31 athletes reporting the concussion, 10 of them, or 25% of those who had had a concussion, didn't tell the coach or trainer about their symptoms. And if they, of course, don't tell that they've had a concussion, and then they go back out and play again, it suggests a potentially strong risk factor for worsening decline cognitively, emotionally, and physically.
Right. And we know about that second impact syndrome. If you get hit again in close approximation to when you had the first concussion, that can be extremely threatening to one's life and future. And so these things are very important. And it suggests, too, that we still have a lot of education to do, both on the signs and symptoms and the importance of reporting. I worry sometimes that kids might not report because they don't want to be pulled out of the game. But some of this suggests that maybe these young female athletes don't know how important it is.
Yeah, I saw also a young woman who was participating in a major dance festival in the region earlier in the summer. And she had, in a dance maneuver, had hit heads with another dancer. And she got dizzy and everything. And the major performance was 2 days from then. And I happened to run into the director and I was like, you know, she's had a bad concussion. She said, well, she's my star. We revolve around her. I said, well, you need to revolve somewhere else for the
right.
next few days, because she should not be doing the jumping and the thing. So I think we have to do education. There's prevention. Hopefully this is a good start.
Agreed. Let's talk about contraception and a tie to depression risk. This is a study that was put out about women, looking at women ages 15 to 34, tracking their contraceptive and antidepressant use over 13 years from 2000 to 2013.
And it looked at women who were taking hormonal contraception and what percentage of them actually developed or increased risk of depression after 6 months. And it was 40%. And it was even kind of seemed to be higher among the women who use progestin-only pills, and that the risk was the greatest in the younger women, the adolescent girls. I think this is I don't know. It's worrisome a little bit on, you know, it's hard to know what to make. It's the first kind of study I've seen like this. This was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Psychiatry subspecialty journal.
It is. And there are many patients who've reported to me, and it's certainly plausible that hormonal changes are linked with depression. We know this. We see it often with Depo-Provera, that there are some increased risks. But I mean, the fact that this was 40% increased risk after 6 months of use, worse with the progestin-only pills, IUD, Depo, is really notable. To me, this is strong enough that it needs to be a part of our routine counseling with our patients. But I also think it's important to point out that most women who use the contraceptives don't get depressed. So it's an increased risk, but it's not to be concerned if you're not having these symptoms and you're taking the medication that's keeping you from getting pregnant and you don't desire pregnancy, then you should keep taking it. Go talk to your doctor about it, but we don't want to overstate that risk.
Right, and there are available good non-hormonal ways of birth control, but this is a conversation between a woman
exactly.
and their doctor, which is what we're encouraging. And for our colleagues who are doctors who are counseling, we do encourage you to bring this risk up. People should be informed. Speaking of being informed, our next Research That Matters, Christy, it's not something I think that we can act on right now, but we thought it was interesting enough we wanted to bring it to your health listeners.
Okay, so the basic gist is this. So even though men make new sperm every 24 hours, 48 hours, women, the conventional wisdom has been that you have the number of eggs that you have in your ovaries when you're born, and that those are the eggs that you have. So we do things around fertility. People can find out what their egg reserve is and all this because you don't make new eggs. But this study suggests that maybe there's a possibility that that's wrong.
Yeah, this was work done at the University of Edinburgh, and they took from Hodgkin's lymphoma patients ovarian biopsies, and 8 of whom were given this new drug, this kind of chemotherapeutic drug called ABVD, and 3 of whom got a stronger drug combination that was known to cause infertility. And then they compared them with 10 healthy women. And the women that got this kind of experimental ABVD treatment had 2 to 4 times the number of visible eggs in the ovarian tissue than the control group. And so this wasn't just a little increase, it was a large increase. And the question is, were these new eggs? It just made those eggs that were there more visible? Because if it's new egg development, that might suggest a whole new category of drugs to help stimulate new eggs. I don't know if it shows that, though.
Right. That certainly would be an overstatement to say it proved that you can grow new eggs. But the fact that they did have an increase in what appeared to be new eggs is certainly worth further investigation, because that would give a lot of promise to people who struggle with infertility.
Speaking of promise, our last Research That Matters, I think, is directly applicable to almost every listener out there. And that is this Mediterranean diet that Christy and I are both big fans of, whole grains, fresh fruits, nuts. And it says, well, what if you take people who are on a Mediterranean diet and you give them extra olive oil, maybe in one group, maybe extra nuts in another group. In the third group, you say, why don't you start eating a low-fat diet? What happens?
Well, I think it's also important to note that in the study, these were adults ages 50 to 80 who were at high risk for heart disease because they smoked, had high blood pressure, or were obese. So this was done in a population of people who were at higher risk to have heart disease. But what they found is that if you add nuts and add extra virgin olive oil to a Mediterranean diet, that you do have some good outcomes compared to taking a low-fat diet, especially related to cognitive decline and some of the other, you know, dementia and other outcomes related to heart disease and those risk factors.
Yeah, those who added nuts had improved memory, and those who had extra virgin olive oil improved the ability to kind of organize thoughts and thinking skills compared to those that who had the low-fat diet that seemed to actually do worse. Now, I do want to comment, this study was done in Spain. It was published in JAMA Internal Medicine. And I think Christy and I, we need to go to Spain to actually
interview these authors and see in detail
what type of olive oil they're using, what nuts they were using.
We need to taste the olive oil. How does it taste?
Taste the nuts. Okay, we're going to we'll do this live from Spain. But that will conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. And we will take a short break. But when we come back, we'll be talking about models of making house calls. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM. WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we're talking about models of home visits, where physicians go into the home to take care of patients. For the first portion of our conversation today, we'll be talking with Dr. Alan Kronhaus, co-founder and CEO of Doctors Making House Calls in Durham, about one model of making home visits. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
You know, Dr. Kronhaus, I've known you for a long time, and there's one word I would describe you as enthusiastic, energetic, and entrepreneurial. I know that's not one word, that's three. But tell us how you became interested from being a provider yourself to being an entrepreneur in business to forming this particular company. How and why did you form this company?
Well, it was really my wife's idea. She had been in a pretty traditional practice in Raleigh and realized that there were many patients who had difficulty getting into the office, who were essentially homebound. And it's a very underserved population. It's really a high needs, high cost population and very underserved. So I guess you could say it was the opportunity to do well by doing good.
And tell us how you first started and what were the first two or three things that you found, perhaps that were unexpected?
Well, we started in our home. I was minding the store and my wife, who is also a physician and the real clinician in the family, was running around the triangle seeing patients in their home. What was unexpected was we found this incredible population of patients who were residents in assisted living, realized that they're very complex, very needy, and very underserved. And that's really been the engine behind our growth. About 80% of our work is providing on-site primary care in assisted living, and the rest is the traditional home visits still.
Well, help us paint a picture of what that looks like from the patient end. Maybe an example of a patient who was really in need of your services in a way that you could fill that in the home that wouldn't be possible otherwise.
Well, again, it's the population we serve is complex. In fact, if you look at some of our data, the most common number of chronic active medical problems in the assisted living resident is 8. And typically they are part of the 5% that accounts for 50% of Medicare expenditures. So we provide what I like to call proactive primary care on site, because these are people who are underserved in part because of access problems. They have problems getting to the doctor. So we see them frequently and in depth and manage their chronic active medical problems before they become financial and clinical crises.
I'm thinking of one patient in particular who I know the family utilized your services, and this patient used to go to their primary care doctor, but they got weaker and weaker and they were in the assisted living center, and they ultimately got to a place where it was just too difficult to come to see their primary care doctor. And simultaneously, they heard about your services. And so on a routine basis, I think on a weekly basis, one of your doctors came out and began to see the patient in the assisted living center. How does that doctor coordinate the types of services that would normally happen in the doctor's office in that assisted living center?
We really provide rather massive support for all of our clinicians, and we have 80 of them now, and we're seeing patients and serving communities from Greenville to Asheville. Our headquarters office, though, is still here. It's actually in Durham, just outside of Research Triangle Park. We employ something like 120 administrative people who provide support to the docs, to their families, to the facility personnel. And one thing that's, I think, noteworthy about our practice is that we provide and charge for only E&M services, no ancillary services.
And to our listeners, explain what that is.
Mm-hmm. Evaluation and management, sometimes called cognitive services. So we rarely do procedures. And as far as the ancillary services, like x-rays and lab work, we farm that out. We have sort of partnership relationships that we've developed over the years with key reference labs or mobile imaging. And so our doctors have no pressure to order anything other than what is medically necessary to take care of the patient.
And so from the patient perspective, they have the benefit of being able to stay in their own home or their own assisted living facility and have the doctor come to them. And from the doctor perspective, instead of going to the office every day in their one clinic, they travel from place to place. What happens from the physician end, they leave there, they document it somewhere, and how do they coordinate their care in the way that they would do their normal clinic office?
I think there are really two keys to answering your question. One is that we become, certainly functionally, if not in name, but usually both functionally and in name, the primary care clinician for all of our patients. So mm-hmm. we provide continuity of care, which includes longitudinal responsibility. And I think that's one of the keys to our success, that we have a real relationship with the patient. We know the patient, we know the family, they trust us, and so forth. And the second thing is that we, from the start, our vision was what I sometimes describe as a geographically dispersed group practice. Mm-hmm. So right from the start, we had electronic records that were not only electronic, but cloud-based. I think we were the first private practice to actually have cloud-based medical records. So all the clinicians walk around, run around with laptops and document right into the medical record system, and they have, no matter where they are, the complete medical record on their patients.
So one of the trends, obviously, in healthcare is this, not only this cost containment, but the patient experience of care and the quality of care. Speak to how, in the type of business that you have, you address what people sometimes call the trifecta, the holy grail. If you can do all three of those things, you must think about this on a daily basis.
Triple aim, so to speak.
Yes.
Well, Doctors Making House Calls is one of 15 practices nationwide selected by CMS.
Center for Medicare Services.
CMS. It's now housed in the Center for Medicare Innovation, CMMI, Medicare Medicaid Innovation. And so the aim of the demonstration was, I guess, proof of concept, you know, do home visits, do what we say they can do, which is lower costs, even while improving quality. And recently, CMS released the year two results, and we were fortunate to be, in effect, the best performing practice in the demonstration of the 15. So we had the lowest cost, the greatest cost reduction, while hitting all of our quality of care targets for the 2 years for which records data is available. So we now have the data to support our contention that we improve quality of care and reduce the cost of care by providing what I've described as proactive primary care.
And my assumption is you'd also have data to say that the patient experience is very positive. And if you extend that to the quadruple aim of the provider experience, I imagine all those 80 providers are getting some satisfaction and joy out of being able to visit people in their homes and be a part of a creative model.
Indeed they are, absolutely. I think there are special advantages to the job role that we use to attract really good clinicians. And, well, we're fishing in a very small, very shallow pond if you talk in terms of good primary care clinicians who are also comfortable with complexity. So we offer, for example, I think the big one is flexibility in scheduling. Mm-hmm. And our folks have a real relationship with patients over time. As I said, very different from the shift work that is so common nowadays among physicians.
We really want to thank you, Dr. Alan Kronhaus, for coming in and talking with us today. Appreciate you taking time and sharing Doctors Making House Call with your health listeners.
Thank you both very much. It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Dr. Kronhaus.
We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking about models of home visits. We'll be right back with your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health. Today on Conversations, we're going to continue our conversation about models of home care. And we're really pleased to have back on the show Dr. Christine Kistler, Research and Assistant Professor, Division of Geriatric Medicine, Department of Family Medicine, the University of North Carolina. And we're going to be talking about the program called REACH, a home care service program sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Welcome back to Your Health, Dr. Kistler.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, Dr. Kistler, we've known each other for a long time, and you are such a proponent of care-at-home models. Why is this an important concept for you personally?
I think for me personally, if you understand older adults, you understand that one size does not fit all, and that there are many highly functional older adults that are able to go in and be with their primary care providers and have meaningful relationships and see their specialists and get the kinds of care that they need. However, we also know that as people age and they become more frail and they have more conditions, it becomes increasingly more difficult for them to get out of their home. And those people deserve care and services just like those people who happen to be able to get in their car and drive themselves to their doctor's office.
Has the concept of home-based care grown perhaps over the last few years? Because I do know you came on the show and you were really passionate several years ago, but it seems like with the growth in geriatric medicine, with the growth and aging of our population, that this is getting to be more, not less important.
We know that 100 years ago, all medical care really was home care. What we had, I think, was this rise of specialty care, and that as we have in the dawn of more comprehensive care come to realize that ongoing primary care is really important, I think we have seen a return to the idea of, for some patients, a small minority of patients, receiving care in their home provides them better care, it prevents them from having to come into the hospital, and they're able to continue having a quality of life and hopefully preserve function for as long as possible. And so I do think as we have shifted away from some of these models that have really arisen over the past 100 years to a more comprehensive type of care, we've seen a resurgence in that. I would say that home-based care is not entirely novel, that the seminal papers that were published looking at how well it delivers services were published over 15 years ago, so that people have been doing this work in places like the VA or over in Kaiser, California, for decades. We have really, with the diffusion of knowledge, it takes a little while for other people to start adopting. So I do think that this is, it's not an entirely novel form of care, but I do think as our perspectives of what healthcare have changed, that there has become a greater emphasis on these types of services.
So let me ask you a question. As a family doctor, certainly we were trained and we still do home visits, but it's not easy. As a matter of fact, one might say it's more complicated than ever. What distinguishes REACH as a program from the traditional physician-centered model of home care?
Well, you know, actually, a lot of home care initially was just allied health, right? It was just your physical therapists and your nurses, and it was a very discreet period of time. And that what has happened with most home care that is sort of medically run is we have a interdisciplinary approach where we have social work and pharmacy and nursing and physicians and nurse practitioners and PAs, and everyone together talks about their area of expertise, because the type of people who are homebound are people who have issues with social issues and pharmaceutical issues and medical issues. And so getting all of those people in the room to talk about these problems, it's a team-based sport. It's a team-based model. We really have to deliver care. You know, it's way more work than one physician, you know, going out to the home and seeing patients really can do, because we aren't trained to be social workers. We aren't trained to be pharmacists. I mean, we have great pharmaceutical understanding, but these people have areas of expertise that these homebound older adults need.
So it's far more than just the physician, what I hear, the entire team. And tell us, because you probably have data now, it seems that the triple aim of healthcare is that everyone's going after is this reduction in cost, improvement of quality, and the patient experience. How does REACH achieve the outcomes that we all know? And if you can do it, gold star.
Thank you for asking that. Our most current data that we have shows that we reduce hospitalizations by 51% and emergency department visits by 35%. And so when it comes to cost, we are cost-saving to the institution. And when it comes to quality, we have gotten awards from local organizations that appreciate the quality of care that we deliver. We are currently looking at some of the quality metrics in terms of services provided. There is a growing movement by CMS and other organizations to look at home-based primary care and home-based palliative care programs and hold them to certain standards. And so we very much have tried to base our program on what is current best evidence, so that do we do care coordination? Do we assess safety? Do we try and help patients attain their goals and set reasonable expectations? What is their experience like? What is their access to care like? Are we doing a good job of educating them about the problems that are important to them? And so that is our aspiration, and we are currently trying to figure out how well we're meeting that, what are areas where we are strong and we need to continue to do what we are doing, and what are areas where we really need to improve. And so just like we can take all of the incredible innovations in lean models and other types of, you know, PDSA cycles and improvement cycles, can we apply some of that to how we do home care? And so we are currently looking at that, but thus far, our metrics look good.
So if I was a family or a listener in Iowa or Idaho or Texas or Massachusetts, across the country, and I said, I really want this type of care, how do I find it? What should I look for?
So there are home-based care comes in a lot of different forms. There are home-based care-only practices where all they do is go into people's homes and provide that care. The REACH program is different from those in that we are nestled within the larger academic institution and the larger healthcare system. So we're called the REACH program because we can reach out to these people from their ambulatory clinics and really help them continue to interface with the larger healthcare system. So we operate best within an accountable care organization or an organization that is really concerned about all aspects of care, that is hospitalizations, as well as getting them to their specialty appointments, as well as their quality of life and those things. And so I think depending on who you are and what you need, it may be very reasonable to have someone who all they do is they come into your home, they draw labs, they can get, you know, allied health involved when they need to. But there are other people who may really benefit from having a program that is embedded or is part of a larger organization of healthcare services. And that's more what we are.
And
if you're in Texas or Idaho and you can find a healthcare organization that a hospital or some sort of health system that has this program, then that would be a good fit for you.
So as the healthcare system grows and the complexity grows, and we all know that the needs to coordinate care between the inpatient and the outpatient prevent readmissions, you see REACH really serving a critical role that perhaps has been underserved and perhaps is still getting defined.
Absolutely. I would like to also point out that there are a number of veterans out there who have not interfaced with the VA system, and I understand there are problems with access throughout the country, but when we examine the quality of care that they provide, it is actually very good, and that the VA has a home-based primary care program that is throughout the country. And so if you are a special type of person, a veteran who has served our country, you have the right to access those things. So I just wanted to point that out, Adam.
Well, and we appreciate that. And Dr. Kistler, if you could leave your health listeners with one final thought about REACH and home-based care, what would it be?
That's a great question. If I had to say one thing about the REACH program, it's that all patients deserve to have doctors who are there for them. All patients deserve to have nurses and social work and all of this access to service. And just because these patients and families are not able to get to their doctor doesn't mean that UNC is abandoning them, that there are programs that we are actively trying to help make their lives better.
Well, we appreciate the work that you're doing, Dr. Kistler. We appreciate the work of the REACH program, and we appreciate you coming back to be a repeat guest on Your Health.
Thank you so much, Adam.
We've been talking with Dr. Christine Kistler, Research and Assistant Professor, Division of Geriatric Medicine, and the Department of Family Medicine at the University of North Carolina, about the REACH program, a model home care program. We're going to take a short break. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And if we have a listener that has a health concern, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we've got some great house calls today. And I'd like to ask our executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our first house call question about someone who's worried about allergic reactions to their skin.
I thought I had an allergic reaction on my skin, but after researching, I think I might have keratosis pilaris. Do you have any advice for treating this? And I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Yeah, I think you did a good job with that. You know, we all get skin reactions at some point in time. I'm sure, Laura,
sure.
You've had some skin reactions.
Absolutely.
You know, you go to bed at night, you wake up the next morning, and your skin's itching. That's
yeah,
how it is.
Definitely.
You know, you're trying to think, like, you know, what happened? And so I imagine in this particular case that there was someone who did kind of wake up and their skin was itching, or maybe they were every day it started getting worse. And so this feeling that maybe it's allergic, or sometimes we call a contact dermatitis, something you've come into contact with. Sometimes it's hard to differentiate that. Like sometimes when you touch poison ivy, you ever had poison ivy?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
kind of,
yeah.
kind of miserable.
It's horrible.
Right. And sometimes allergic can be stimulated by a medication, or it can be stimulated by a new piece of clothing, a fiber. People's skin can be really quite sensitive. But that's very different than this kind of chronic disease of this something called keratosis pilaris. The keratin is that kind of top layer of skin. So this is a disease of that top layer of skin that normally we lose a little bit of that skin every day. And in this particular, that top layer of skin is irritated. It's a little bit different, a little bit thicker. It's this thickened, slightly abnormal skin that's really pretty common in kids and adults. And for most people, yeah, you may look at it and go, God, I've got a lot of freckles on my arms or my legs, but you don't think anything above it. But in some adults, it kind of itches. Trying to avoid soaps, particularly harsh soaps, deodorant soaps, and using soap substitutes that you can use, and then certainly emollients or anything that's lubricating. And then finally, things that can kind of help peel off those little dots a little bit, things that have, you can get them over the counter. They either have lactic acid in them or a different acid that might help do some superficial appealing. Those are things you can do on your own. Sometimes if you're going to go to your primary care doctor or dermatologist, they may do things like retinoids. You've heard of Retin-A, mm-hmm. a type of retinoid prescription product, sometimes used for acne. Sometimes topical steroids if it's really itchy. If that doesn't work, you better go see a specialist.
Sure.
You know, so good question. Thanks so much. What's our very next house call, Laura?
I had shingles in my 30s, and needless to say, it was not fun. Now that I'm in my 60s, do I still need to get a shingles vaccine?
Well, first off, one of the most painful conditions is potentially initially having shingles. It's very painful. And what we are glad you didn't have is this something called post-herpetic neuralgia, post-shingles neuralgia. That just sounds bad, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I imagine, is it lingering pain or something from
yeah.
the shingles?
Yeah, it's severe pain. Take the worst pain that you have in shingles, and that pain stays in that same place for months, if not longer.
Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah, it really is. And the problem is it's sometimes difficult to predict, and shingles can happen anywhere on the body. So if you can imagine that kind of pain in your face or on your scalp, you know, in very sensitive areas of the skin, it can be really, really painful. And we really want to prevent that. And that's what the shingles vaccination can do. It can really not only make if you get shingles, be much milder, but it can also really reduce the likelihood if you get shingles, you're going to get that post-herpetic neuralgia and reduces the chance you get shingles, period. So we really do recommend the shingles. Now, the question really is here, when do you get it? Most people say if you're over age 50 and you have some risk factors for having a bad case of shingles, that maybe you should get it. And if you're over age 60, it's recommended really for pretty much everyone, except if you're really, you know, have bad immunosuppression, in which case you probably shouldn't get it. They do recommend it here, interestingly enough, for people who've had shingles because, you know, a lot of people say, oh, I had shingles, but you don't know if they really had shingles.
Yeah, that's
can they
what
really
I
prove
was wondering.
It? You know, and there's not really a downside to that. So it's really kind of trust but verify.
Right.
and then go on and get that. It's just really a one-time, you know, really well tolerated. So I don't really think there's a downside. I don't know if you have any other thoughts about it yourself.
I don't want shingles. That's my thought.
Well, you're not quite at the age yet, but when you are, you'll know what to
say.
I'll
get my vaccine.
What's our very last house call?
Every year, my dentist insists on taking another set of dental x-rays, even when I don't have any symptoms that indicate a problem. Are dental x-rays something you should get done frequently?
Oh, I love this question. You know why I love this question?
Why?
I asked my dentist this myself,
nice.
A family doctor going into their dentist, they're about to do x-rays, and the worst thing you want probably is for your dentist is like a family doc coming in saying, do I really need these x-rays?
You had your own house calls with your dentist.
Oh, yeah, and I could tell that by the look of the dentist, who's since retired, but she was not real happy with me. At least that's my interpretation of it. But I thought it was a good question. I think this is a really good question. And I'll tell you something I've learned, because I did look into this, is that a lot of dental diseases are diagnosed really through the x-rays. So they can have suspicion that there's a cavity. They can have a suspicion of some bone involvement, tooth involvement. And the x-rays, at least what they tell me, and I believe this to be true, really can be helpful. There are two types of dental x-rays, which I didn't know until I had looked into this, but the ones that are done kind of within the mouth, those are the common ones, can look at those cavities and the tooth root and the bone. And then the ones that are outside that show the teeth, but it's really looking at the jaw and the skull. They stick that piece of paper deep in your mouth and you have to turn your jaw awkwardly and you bite on those, are called those bite wings. The big thing is, are they doing them digitally? If they're doing the digital, which is the new, more modern technology, the radiation dose is less. And then to limit this panoramic, where they go and they take this full of all the teeth, that I think it's reasonable to ask your dentist really how frequently do you really need that. Single best thing I think is good preventive care. We want to thank all of our listeners today for their questions. And we hope if you want to share your own questions, you can mail them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or search our health app, Your Health, one word, for a free download. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for the sponsorship, our great guests today, Dr. Alan Kronhaus and Dr. Chrissy Kistler. We'll help you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL. presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.